I call this one day retreat a practice for a difficult time. And taking refuge is a really good place to begin in difficult times. I mean, think of what a refuge is. A refuge is this place that we feel safe in. And so even if it's a mental place we feel safe in, it's important that we have access to that and we actually consciously choose to go to that safe place in difficult times. So that's where I would like to begin, is by us collectively going to this safe place. Traditionally, at this point, if you, this is the beginning of you taking essentially silence, where other than when I actually ask for questions, you've decided for the next 8 hours to not communicate with each other, not to, you know, turn on your cell phone and check for messages or all those things that we do then we communicate. We're actually consciously choosing to withdraw from the world a little bit. And that's part of taking refuge, is we part of being in that safe place is to withdraw from places that sometimes are less than safe, get us distracted in various ways. So having sent you the refuges, if you know them, you can chant them with me. If not, just have that intention in your mind. It'll be a perfect way to start. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutyampi, Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutyampi, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutyampi, Sangham saranam gacchami, Tatyampi, Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatyampi, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatyampi, Sangham saranam gacchami. So let's begin. And the first thing I want to do this morning, for a good part of the morning, is talk about and work with concentration. There's so much going on out there in the world on a day-to-day basis in a variety of distressing ways. Sometimes not so distressing, but wonderful, but there's still a lot going on. And it's important that we have tools that allow us to not get so distracted. And concentration is, from the Buddhist perspective, the key to that whole idea. Being able to actually consciously go to a more concentrated state is, especially for beginners, but also for more advanced students, it's where we want to really put our focus right now, I think, is in the idea of concentration. Excuse me while I blow my nose here. So, in this tradition, in the Theravada tradition I teach and practice in, one of the primary methods of concentration practice is to really simplify the instructions from the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha starts the instructions by talking about just paying attention to the breath, just focusing on breath to the exclusion of everything else. This is a very definitely a concentration practice. It allows us to sort of narrow our focus and narrow our minds in a sense to just this one thing. So we have this very simple meditation object. I mean, the beauty of the breath as a meditation object is that it's always there. It never goes away. We always have access to the breath. So it's something we can use to concentrate on. And so there's several things I want you to do as we go into an actual meditation period. And that number one is that we want to focus on seeing if we can actually stay with an entire breath. I mean, really experience the sensation of an inhale and the sensation of an exhale. And I want to use a practice called noting, which is how I've learned this practice from several different teachers and how I've always practiced. And I think noting is particularly effective in increasing the level of concentration. And so noting, basically what you do is, as you inhale, very softly in the mind, you note what's actually happening right now. I mean, remember, that's a definition of mindfulness, knowing what's happening right now. Then if we note just softly in, or inhale, or if you like something a little more descriptive, rising or lifting, which is the physical sensation we'll experience as we inhale. And then as we exhale, we note out. Exhale, falling, dropping. Once again, something more descriptive. And whether you choose the simple one or the more descriptive ones, it's really very up to you, personal. If you've already got a practice where you have certain notes you use for these things, then that's fine. You can also, as it's described in the sutta, note the quality of the breath. Sometimes there'll be a particular breath where it's like, boy, that was deep, or short, or choppy, or raspy, or long. So you can, if it's immediately apparent, use a word like that to actually note that in-breath or that out-breath. The trick here is not to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what you're going to note and how are you going to note. Don't go there, because that's just, now I've got distracted into trying to figure things out, which is why we're trying to not do, in a sense. So we want to just, if it's immediately, it's like something sort of jumps out about a particular inhale or exhale, use a more descriptive word if that word comes to mind. Otherwise, just plain old in and out, or rising, falling, or whatever you've chosen as your basic pair of notes, is perfectly fine noting. Of course, what actually happens is we're going to go in, out, in. Oh, I shouldn't have eaten that breakfast burrito. It's really spicy. And I mean, the mind's going to get distracted by something. And away we go in our minds, thinking about whatever. What am I doing here? I should have gone for a walk all day instead with my friend. Who knows what the thoughts are going to be, but there's going to be thoughts. We're all human beings. We all know this is going to happen. And so what do we do then? Well, at a certain point in that chain of thoughts, you're going to remember, oh, wait, I'm sitting here practicing. Remembering is another translation of the word sati, which is usually translated as mindfulness. So remembering, in a sense, is the key to this practice in some sense. We keep going back and remembering what we're doing. And so when you've been in that chain of thoughts and then you remember, then you go, back to the breath for now. In this concentrated form, we just note thinking, because that's what's been happening, and then back to the breath. We don't hesitate. We just return to the next breath. And it's not... The tricky part of this, however, is that if we're not careful, we judge ourselves. It's like, oh, there I am, not paying attention to the breath again. What's wrong with me? I'm no good. I can't do this. Well, you know, now we're just doing, we're thinking about thinking about thinking very quickly, spinning out, right? It's called papancha. And we just need to go, no, no need. This is like me being a normal human being with a normal mind. Back to the breath. The judgment is just another form of distraction. And we have to just acknowledge that. I mean, in a worst case scenario, you're thinking, you note thinking, and then you start judging. You might even note judging and then go back to the breath. If that helps. But it's more just that seamless transition back to the breath, paying attention to what's actually happening right now with the breath. That's what we want to have happen. So that's really all I have to say at the beginning. I actually want to jump right in to practice and get ourselves settled a little bit and a little more concentrated. So I'm going to turn off my mic in a second, and we'll sit for half an hour. And then I'll ring the gong at the end of that sitting period, and we can then continue on talking about what comes next. This is going to be, just by the way, quite a traditional Vipassana, Theravada Vipassana retreat. We're going to have periods of me yakking, teaching. We're going to have periods of sitting practice. We're going to have periods of walking practice. And we'll intersperse those all through the day with a break in the middle for eating practice, which is we all enjoy. Okay, so for now, just find your upright, comfortable position, settle in, and we will sit for half an hour. Remember that the noting itself is quite soft. I've heard it described, you know, the image I like is that you're polishing a fine piece of crystal with a very fine, soft cloth. It's that level of touch. So it's not, there's no, it's not forceful. It's not yelling. It's the opposite of yelling. Let's put it that way. So the noting is just there to keep us more tightly tethered to what's actually happening right now, which is we're breathing. That's what we've chosen as our meditation object for now. So just from that settled physical place, settle the mind by just noting that next inhale and that next exhale. And continue on now for about half an hour. So let's continue on here. What I want to do now is talk a little bit about walking practice, and then you can all actually do it. And I'm going to explain walking practice just because everybody does this somewhat differently. So I'll tell you how I would want to do it and how we can actually make this a particularly a concentration practice, because that's what we were emphasizing today. And basically, the most important thing is remember that walking practice isn't going for a walk. This is just another form of practice. You know, the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutta says the practice, walking, standing, seated, or lying down. So this is just one of those on the list. We've been practicing seated. We can practice walking. If you want to try sometime a whole sitting period, you could do the whole sitting period standing if you're interested in experimenting. It's quite interesting when you, especially if you're sleepy or full after lunch, that's always a good time to do standing practice because it keeps you awake. Anyhow, so walking practice, you find a space, whether that's a space in your house or a space outside, which I highly recommend because if you go outside, you'll get some fresh air and it'll perk you up. where you can walk about 20 steps, not far. It doesn't like, it doesn't have to be a long run in either direction. You just, you stand at one end of that 20 pace thing and you just walk for 20 paces. You get to the end of that line and you turn around and you walk back. And then you turn around and you walk back. So it's like this back and forth in this particular space. As I said, whether it's, this is like I'm down the hallway in your apartment or your house, or this is outside, whatever suits you. And you can do both, you know, oh, right now it's kind of nice out, let's go do it outside. Oh, it's getting kind of cool, I'll do my walking inside. That's all fine. As far as the noting is concerned, because I want you to actually practice noting while we're doing the walking practice, the noting is, can be extremely simple. Every time you take a step, you just note step. What's actually happening is I'm stepping. So I just note step, step, step. At the same time, you are probably putting some mental energy into really paying fine attention to the sensations in your feet, or perhaps your feet and ankles, so that there's this physical sensation that you're tuning into, just like the breath. I mean, in the breath, we're tuning into the physical sensations of the breath. Now we're going to tune into the physical sensations of walking. The most predominant energy of walking is the actual sensation of the foot hitting the ground. So every time the foot hits the ground, you mentally note step. As far as speed of walking is concerned, this is really up to you. In general, I find that walking slower gives, probably enhances the concentration. But if walking slower, you just get distracted, then walk faster. Sometimes when I go start a walking practice, I'm sort of, my mind is sort of whizzing around a little bit. So I walk fast for a while. And then as my mind settles, then I slow down. So it isn't like I don't have to choose a speed and stick with it. Let your speed vary based on the state of your mind at the time. And that will really help make walking practice more relevant, and it'll make it work better. Finally, what do you do with these things, with your hands and your arms? I mean, there you are walking. Well, you can just let them hang down and swing back and forth. But there are two things you can do. One is kind of formal. Maybe I'll have to shift my screen so you can see this. There we go. You can actually take your left hand, tuck the thumb in, and put it here so that this arm bone is parallel to the floor. Put this hand on top, and then sort of tuck your wings in a little bit. This is kind of, feels very sort of formal, but it also, it's like contained, sort of like holding in energy in a sense. I find this very useful to practice like this. I've also practiced with my hands in my pockets, with my hands clasped behind my back, with my arms swinging more vigorously because I'm trying to sort of wake myself up. So once again, don't feel like you have to sort of pick one and stick with it. Based on the state of mind, and be a little experimental if you haven't done a lot of this form of practice. Find what works for you and then practice. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take about a 20 minutes. So first of all, let's just do a little time check. My time now says 9:52. So in about 20 minutes, we're going to come back here. I'm going to leave the Zoom, the room open, but I'm going to turn my video off and my sound off and go walk outside on my back porch. And then I'll come back and join you, and we'll continue on in this process from there. So have a nice time doing walking practice and enjoy yourself. So I want to talk more about the importance of concentration, which is sort of a big theme of what I'm doing today. And so I'm going to turn to the experts here. this is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And I want to read a fairly long section of what he's saying here. The strengthening of concentration comes about through the continuity of mindfulness. We can practice this continuity in two ways. The first way is cultivating a directed awareness of a single object. We practice keeping the mind steady on the breath, the movements of a step, a sound. The second way develops a more choiceless awareness. Here we are cultivating one pointedness of mind on changing objects. This is called momentary samadhi. Our practice is the skillful interweaving of these two approaches. We can focus on a single object when the mind is sluggish or distracted in order to develop internal joy and serenity. And then when the mind is again collected, we can open to an undirected, choiceless mode of awareness. After some time, we get a very intuitive feel for which is appropriate at any given time. One of the great gifts of the deepening concentration is that it helps keep the various mental hindrances at bay. It is like building a fence to keep out unwanted intruders. By temporarily dampening the force of lust and craving, aversion and restlessness, it opens us to the more refined pleasures of the mind. This in turn gives us impetus to develop concentration even more. Over time, we see the default level of concentration increase in our mind, which changes how we feel and how we are in the world. We create an inner environment of peace. Although concentration is not the final goal of the practice, still it plays an essential role on the path of awakening. The Buddha emphasized this when he said that respect for concentration is one of the things that leads to the longevity of the Dharma, to its non-decay and non-disappearance. This is an important statement for the transmission of Dharma to the West. We would like everything to be instant, even enlightenment, and we often don't want to put in the time or effort to develop and deepen our concentration. But as samadhi gets stronger in our daily lives, it helps us find that place where we can increasingly abide free of desires and discontent in regard to the world. And this peaceful composure becomes the basis for greater happiness and freedom. Sounds pretty good to me, all right? And also he's talking very directly about, you know, the theme of the retreat, this, you know, practice for a difficult time. Concentration allows us to sort of not be so distracted. I mean, that's the definition of concentration in a sense. It's the opposite of being distracted. So what I'd like to do is put more emphasis on concentration on the breath for the next sitting period. And I want to suggest three different skillful means that you could apply to concentrating on the breath more precisely. And I've worked with all three of these at different times in my practice, and you sort of learn which ones you like and develop them to suit you. So these are all suggestions as to what you might try out. First is called aiming and sustaining. Vitakka and vichara in Pali. These are the first two steps of what are the five steps of concentration. And basically what we're saying here is on a moment-to-moment basis, we want to do two things. We want to aim to see the very beginning of any particular in-breath or out-breath. See if we can see just that moment when it actually starts. And then see if we can sustain and pay attention to all the amazing things that happen just in an in-breath or an out-breath. How much sensation is involved and how that sensation shifts in the body as the inhalation or exhalation continues. Basically, what we're doing here is making the breath more interesting. Like, oh, we're becoming fascinated by the breath. And that's going to help us stay with the breath. This is going to help with the concentration by actually becoming more interested in the breath itself. Aiming and sustaining. And we just, every inhale, every exhale, we try and see the very beginning and we try and sustain through the entire thing. Often where the sustaining disappears, by the way, is near the end, particularly on the out-breath. The out-breath, somehow the very end of out-breath is sort of like, ew. It's not that pleasant. In fact, that's often for many people where we space out. At the end of an out-breath is where the mind drifts because it's so unpleasant. I mean, you can think of every inhale as a birth and every exhale as a death. Well, when we're getting close to death, that's when we don't want to pay attention, right? So we can think of it in that way if that helps. But it's interesting as you start to really pay more refined attention by sustaining on the breath, you start to see where your druthers are, whether your likes and dislikes start to arise, even in just simply paying attention to the breath. So that's a skillful means, number one. Number two is to actually have what I'll call a touch point, a physical spot where the sensation of the breath is most obvious to you. And everybody's different. There are three normal ones that I've seen suggested, and I've played with it various times. One is that to pay attention to the belly, because as you inhale, at the start of an inhale, the belly expands, and at the end of an exhale, the body it contracts. It's often the most obvious sensation of breath is the movement of the abdomen, the lower abdomen. Because, the diaphragm is going up and down and the belly is going in and out based on that diaphragm going up and down. So there's a lot of internal sensation there. Maybe even external if you feel the belly expanding against your clothing, perhaps. So that's choice number one. Choice number two is the heart center. You can actually, as you inhale, feel that heart center opening and lifting. It's quite a distinct sensation when you tune into it. And on the exhale, you feel the opposite, that sort of shutting down, closing sensation. These are subtle sensations. We're not talking about really strong sensations at all. They're quite subtle. And the third one is to put your mind right here on the top of the upper lip and feel the air going in up past the upper lip on the inhale and out past the upper lip on the exhale. For me, I find that one not so pleasant. I tried it out. It wasn't really for me. Other people I know swear by the upper lip method. Okay, so you have to really try this out for yourself. I think part of it is I have a mustache on. Maybe my mustache gets in the way and I can't feel anything. So, so that's skillful means number two. Skillful means number three, and this is one I use a lot, particularly when I'm distracted. And that's actually counting the breaths. But here's the thing. You count backwards from 10. So it's in, out, 10. In, out, 9. Until you get all the way down to 1 without making any mistakes or drifting off in the middle, which don't be surprised if you do. But when you get all the way back to 1, down to 1, then you just start at 10 again. But here's the rules. If it's like in, out, 10, in, out, And you get to put in, out, six, and you go in, out, I think it's six, but I'm not sure. Anyway, then go back and start at 10 again. No ifs, ands, or buts. Okay, go back and start again. One of my teachers says, if you see at least part of the breath, at least partly where you are, then that's okay. But if you're really like, duh, I don't know, then time to start again. And so the counting is just like noting. It's like, it's just this soft wording that's making you concentrate more, because now you have another thing to concentrate on, and that is, where am I in the count? You have to remember that as well. So it gives you this other layer of concentration, in a sense. So the obvious question is, why 10? And this is strictly out of people experimenting, including myself, but more when the instructions I've got from other people. I mean, some people say 8, not 10. It's a nicer number somehow, 8 than 10. But you don't want to start with like 20 or 30, too much. You know, it's just too much going on. So 10 is simple enough. 5 would be too simple. 10 seems to be just about right. You know, more than 10 gets to be too much. So maybe somewhere between 5 and 10 is what suits you. So you can, once again, see if you prefer something other than 10. I've been working with 10 for years, and it's just fine for me. So there's these three forms of skillful means: aiming and sustaining, which is basically trying to make the breath more interesting. So being interested helps concentration. Having a touch point. So the thing with the touch point is like, you're still paying attention to the breath itself, but because breathing is a physical sensation, having a touch point once again tunes us into the breath, tethers us a little more tightly to the breath by having that touch point awareness, wherever that space in the body is. And I suggested 3, remember, belly, heart center, lip, but maybe for you, it's some other place. Some people say the throat, for instance. You know, so you can feel free to experiment and find what suits you and see how that works. And then this idea of counting backwards from 10, counting the breath backwards from 10, is just like, it's a mental trick that makes us pay attention more and concentrate more. Makes it less likely the mind's going to wander. So these are just skillful means, right? Things we can try to see what works for us. All of this is in aid of what the thing that Joseph said. I have to find the page again. He's right at the very beginning of what he said. He said, the strengthening of concentration comes about through continuity of mindfulness. So all of these skillful means are directly related to continuity of practice. And it's continuity of practice that increases not only concentration, but deepens our mindfulness. All the retreats I've ever done, at some point, at least once, if not many, many times, the people who are teaching the retreat will say, now let's pay attention to continuity of practice. It's like the key, particularly, within one particular sitting or one particular walking, but in a broader sense, in this idea of being on retreat. So another thing we have to watch for is that we turn something like this day-long retreat into, oh, there's sitting practice, and then there's walking practice. And the space in between those two isn't practice time somehow or other in our minds. We sort of skip over that. You know, I'm going to sit, and then, oh, I have to go to where I'm going to be walking. And in that space in between, we space out. This is very common. speaking from vast experience in spacing out, and it's like somehow the mind says, oh, break time. And so to make a retreat more effective, the more continuity we have, so when it's actually time to go walking, and we'll talk about that later, we're actually gonna make sure as best we can that we maintain continuity. So, you know, you're gonna stand up and then you're gonna walk to where you're doing your walking practice. So you're already, from the moment you stand up, doing walking practice. And then when you come back and you sit for the next sitting period, you're walking, 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 then you sit, now you're doing sitting practice. Continuity of practice really helps deepen the practice on a long-term basis. And so I just wanted to emphasize that as because it's so important. That's why retreats work, is because the more we have continuity of practice, the more the retreat's going to benefit us and work for us. Okay, so I think, yes, that's everything I have to say. So once again, we're going to have a sitting practice of about half an hour. So settle into your spot. And I will just think about all the various things you can do to concentrate. Just paying attention to the breath, just for now. We're going to open up soon. But for this whole sit, just pay attention to the breath again. Even if you're used to having a more expansive practice, it's sometimes quite useful to just narrow things down to the simplest of practices. And then make it as interesting as you can, which will help you stay with the concentration. So I'll turn off my mic now and we'll sit. So before we actually go out for more walking practice, I wanted to talk a little bit about how we can apply skillful means to deepening the concentration while we're walking. Just as there are skillful means for the sitting practice that we talked about before. And for me, there's really only one thing I've discovered that really works for me in terms of making walking practice more concentrated. And that is to actually aim, but here we are, it's sort of like aiming and sustaining in a sense, in that we want to see the different sections of a particular step. So we could actually, if we slow down enough, you have to walk a little bit slower when you do this. You can have basically a note that says lift as the foot is being lifted, a note move as the foot is being moved, and a note place as the foot is being put back down on the ground. So you've just broken that step into three distinct phases and noted all three phases. So here we are again using skillful means just to put more attention on what's actually happening. Because the original instruction was just to pay attention to the sensations in the feet. But actually, there's very distinctly different sensations happening even in one step. There's the lifting sensation is very different from the moving sensation, which is very different from the placing sensation. So it could be lift, move, place. I know some people prefer lifting and moving and placing, you know, a more active form. And then there's one other part to this. And this is something I personally found when I was working with this particular form of noting in the walking practice. And when I actually explained this to my teacher at the time, initially my teacher was quite horrified. that I had done this, because it was not traditional in any sense of the word. But what I discovered was, when I'm lifting a foot, that's the primary sensation, the primary input was in the sensation of the actual lifting of the foot. But when I was moving the foot, the primary sensation was in the foot that wasn't moving. It was like the foot that was on the ground taking weight. That's the sensation that caught my attention more. And then in the placing, then the primary energy was once again in the sensation of actually putting the foot down. So when I started practicing this and started noticing this, I would literally, between lift and move and place, keep shifting my attention back and forth from one foot to the other. So that in every note, I would be shifting from one foot to the other. This is, I will tell you, non-traditional, but it really worked for me. So I'm sharing this with, And now, here's one other issue that you're probably going to discover if you start to do this. When does placing end and lifting begin? Because you're placing one foot. Well, as you're placing that foot, that other foot is starting to move already. So when do you stop paying attention to placing and start paying attention to lifting? Figure that out. I don't know. There's no clean, simple explanation for this. You have to sort of experiment and see when you think those things the emphasis shifts from the placing to the shifting, to the lifting. So that's part of the experiment in a sense. So if you are, as I am, fascinated by concentration and fascinated by walking practice, which I absolutely love, then try this more detailed form of noting and see if that helps with the concentration. It has worked quite well for me. Later on in the day, I'll talk about yet another way we can note when we're walking, but it's sort of the other side of the concentration, which I'll talk about next time we talk about sitting. So for now, I would like to suggest that we all, it's now 11:06 in my time frame here. I suggest we're going to walk until, and we're going to rejoin here at 11:30. We're going to start up the actual practice, teaching practice again. So I'm about to hit my pause button here, and so I'm recording this, and you're going to go off and actually do some walking practice and then come back for 11:30. So that's like 24 minutes from now officially, and we'll continue on from there. Okay, so where do we go from here? And that's, how do we shift, in a sense, from what we've been doing, this concentration practice, to what I'll call more traditional open mindfulness practice? And I want to emphasize that there are these two distinct forms of concentration. And so that we're not really stopping concentration. We're just shifting the form that we're using. There's the form, and this is what Joseph said in what I read earlier. There's two forms. The first one is having a particular object, like the breath. But, in other traditions, that might be visualization. It might be mantra. If you practice a metta, it can be the metta phrases. These are all objects of meditation that are sort of called one-pointed concentration. We keep coming back to the same object over and over and over again. But the other form of concentration is this sort of open form where we basically have what's called moment-to-moment concentration, because every time we note, we're just shifting to note what's most prominent in that moment. But it's still requires an concentration. It's still a concentration practice. It's this other form of open moment-to-moment concentration as opposed to fixed concentration on a particular object. Just two different things. And these are both of these forms are part of the traditional practice without exception, as far as I'm concerned. So I want to read something from the sutta here. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. If you're not familiar with the sutta, this is Samyutta Nikaya is the collected teachings. And in this particular volume of teachings of the Buddha, all the teachings the Buddha had about a particular topic are all put together, not all of them, but all the important ones. In one case, I think there's 169 teachings on codependent arising, for instance. You know, but this particular one is it's called the book on the six sense bases, which is what we're going to talk about. Also, I'll just read the sutta and then we'll comment on it and see how we actually put this into practice. So this is at Savati. Bhikkhus, I will teach you the all. Listen. And what, bhikkhus, is the all? The eye and forms, the ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and tastes, the body and tactile objects, the mind and mental phenomena. This is called the all. If anyone, bhikkhus, should speak thus, having rejected this all, I shall make known another all. That would be a mere empty boast on his part. If he were questioned, he would not be able to reply, and further, he would meet with vexation. For what reason? Because that would not be within his domain. This is quite strong words for the Buddha. He's saying, anybody says anything different, I'm sorry, they're wrong. And not only are they wrong, they'll meet with vexation, which I think is a great phrase. So what he's saying here is if we want to sort of open wide and note everything that's arising, actually pay attention to all the different things that are arising, there's really, at any one moment, only one of six things. But we have what are called the six sense doors, and one of those sense doors is active and has caught our attention. So we might be, you know, we might be hearing something, seeing something, tasting something, smelling something, feeling in the tactile sense, some body sensation, or we're thinking. And so the noting can simply become noting the actual sense door, in a sense, that's operating, that's caught our attention. So the noting could be as simple as hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. Or, as we did with the breath, remember when I said with the breath, if there's some quality, some flavor of that sensation that seems obvious, catches your attention, then use that as the note, because that's going to pull you a little closer. It's going to bind you a little closer to the actual sensation. It's going to make the connection stronger, which will increase continuity of practice. So for instance, if you were smelling something, it might be, you know, the word might come into mind, foul, sweet, you know, spicy. There's lots of different words we might use to describe a particular odor. Same with the taste. With the touch, with the body sensation, it might be firm, it might be hot, it might be cold, it might be tingly, it might be painful. Who knows? You know, these are all things, words we use to describe sensation. And so just as I said when we were talking about noting the breath, if something you're noting has a particular quality that catches your attention and the word for it immediately pops into mind, use that as the note. the danger of what I've just said is that we start thinking about how I'm going to note something. Oh, what was that? Oh, okay, now was that, should I call that? You know, we get into this internal conversation about what's going on as opposed to just paying attention to what's actually happening. So we have to be careful. And this is a skill we learn over time of when I'm drifting too far into figuring out as opposed to just noting. Now, there's several other things I would like you to pay attention to, however. One is that the note is not about the content of what's happening. So I'm sitting here and I hear a car going by outside. You know, it's got a loud muffler or something. I don't note car going by. That's too much content. What I note is hearing, or I might note loud. I might, you know, some quality of that sound. I might hear a bird singing and I'll say, instead of bird singing, or gee, that sounds like a blue jay, you know, I might just say hearing, or I might say sweet or shrill for that sound. So we have to be very careful not to get into content, because content quickly leads into thinking about the last time I heard a blue jay, or how much I like blue jays, or how much I don't like blue jays, or those blue jays are always stealing stuff from my bird feeder, or blah, you know, our mind goes one of those places pretty quickly if we're not careful. So the less content in the note, the better. Also, it's important that we understand that this actual process is passive, not active. So I'm hearing, not listening. Listening is an act of going out to hear something. Hearing is just the act of actually hearing. You know, something happened, our eardrum vibrated in a certain way, and there was a noise, and I heard. As opposed to going out, using the mind to go out and seek to hear something, which is listening. And we want to always stay on the side of the passive hearing, not the active listening, when we try and do this. So now there's one other quite big question we have to ask, is that's like, how do I choose what to know? There's so much going on, which is true. I mean, basically, you have about 20 sensations a second, something like that. Well, you're not going to note all 20 of them. You'd go pretty crazy if you did very quickly. So how do I choose what to note, and how frequently should I note? I'm not going to note 20 times a second. What's the frequency of noting? And so the general rule of thumb is every 3 or 4 seconds, you note whatever is most predominant at that moment. So there's something every time you note that stands out from everything else. This background noise of 20 things a second. Something stands out quite distinctly from everything else. That's what you note. So the noting might go something like hearing, hearing, tasting, thinking. I mean, it shifts moment every time you note. It's like there's this little decision you make. What am I going to note now? That's almost like too much thinking. But you see where I'm going here. It's like we keep choosing what's most predominant at that moment, and that's what we note. And that's what, and so the continuity flows along from there. Two things we have to watch for, however. One is that we note, and then we immediately start trying to figure out what we're going to note next. We don't want to go there. That's way too active. You note, there's a pause, dump, dump, note, pause, dump, note. So actually noting what's actually happening now, not what I figured out over the last 3 seconds, which seems like not much time, but actually it's quite a lot of time in this process. So we're trying to just really stay very precisely in the moment, exactly what's happening right now. So that's one thing we have to watch for. And the other thing I want to mention is that if we're not careful, get sort of lost in the blandness. The truth is that though some things are quite sharp and are obvious to note, there are lots of times when there's nothing pleasant, nothing unpleasant, which is what makes things sharp, makes them stand out. Everything's just sort of neutral. There's nothing in particular that grabs you. In that case, when you're at that point, when you're about to note, instead of, well, of all these things that are sort of vague there in the background, what am I going to note? If it seems like everything is neutral, just go back to the breath, which is conveniently always there. And just note what's happening with the breath in that moment. So the breath is what's called the anchor of the practice. You can always go back there and note breath. And then pause, dump, dump. Oh, now that sensation in my knee is pretty strong, and that's what you note. So there might even be just half a breath where you note the breath. So this is called anchored open awareness. This is the official name for it. There is another form called choiceless awareness, where you don't have an anchor. If you've never done this before, I strongly suggest you hang out with an anchor for a while. It's like a safe haven. I can always go there to that anchor and note that, until your practice of noting gets strong and you can then open up even wider into this field of choiceless awareness. I'm just checking my notes here to see if I've forgotten anything. Now, so that's the thing. It's like we've got these six sense doors, with the mind just being another sense door as far as the Buddha is concerned. And we're just noting what's actually happening right now, but in this sort of wide open sense of like whatever catches my attention, that's fine. That's what I'll note. So now we've had this very precise, just the breath noting. And then we have this sort of more open anchored awareness form of noting, which is this moment to moment, the objects of meditation keeps changing. How do we know which one to practice at any particular time? It's a very important question in these teachings. And I wanted to read again a little section that what I read from Joseph earlier. Our practice is a skillful interweaving of these two approaches. We can focus on a single object when the mind is sluggish or distracted in order to develop internal joy and serenity. And then when the mind is again collected, we can open to an undirected, choiceless mode of awareness. After some time, we get a very intuitive feel for which is appropriate at any given time. So this is where skill in practice really starts to become obvious. This takes a certain amount of skill to figure out in the moment, essentially, what should I be doing now? You know, I'm sitting there and I'm just like having what I would call a train wreck sitting period, where things are just like all over the place. And I can't just keep it together at all, then I probably want to do very focused practice. where I'm just paying attention to the breath, maybe counting breaths, something very precise. Yeah. Or I'm sitting there and I've now got the mind into, you know, what Joseph calls a place of joy and serenity. Gee, this is kind of nice. Let's open it up again. So even in one particular sitting, I might do some of one and some of another and then go back to the first one because, oh, I got too wild and crazy again. So we have to, this is the skillful part of practice where we keep choosing which lane we're going to drive in. There is, by the way, a middle lane that you can, some people play with, where you can have, I'm going to have breath, but I'm also going to have sound. I'm also going to have hearing. That's what I, so I can note the breath or I can note what I'm hearing. Hearing, the interesting thing about hearing is that just like breath, there's pretty much always something going on in terms of sound, either externally around us, you know, the fridge humming, whatever, or those internal sounds we often hear when we start to really pay attention to what we're hearing. There's that sort of background sound in the mind that's always there, pretty much. For some people more than others, but there's always some sort of internal body sound vibration happening that we sometimes tune into. So that might be a middle between just breath and everything. So I've said all this because I'm trying to make it really clear that this practice at this point, if we're going to pay attention and to the concentration aspect of what we're doing, it's pretty wide open, and we have to learn how to manipulate the practice in a sense to suit what's going on in our minds right now. And we each figure this out for ourselves over time as we practice. It's not like, oh, I always have to do this or I always have to do that. Both of these forms are equally valid forms of practice, and we sort of can shift back and forth between them based on what's going on right now. This is where as I said earlier, this is where the skill in practice becomes very obvious. This is a learned skill that we're practicing. Remember, they call it practice for a reason, right? When you're practicing something, it means you're learning how to do it. You know, we're not, this isn't called expert do it. It's called practice. We actually have to learn as we go and be aware that that's what's going on and be sort of a little kind to ourselves that sometimes when I practice, I mess up. You know, I just get totally lost in something, and that's when we go, oh, that's okay. So, you know, when we talked earlier about that non-judging mind, really important that we don't judge our practice. We don't go, oh, I can't do this open awareness stuff, or oh, I can't, you know, that's just wasting energy and distracting yourself in unskillful ways. So we have to sort of be open to the fact that we'll figure things out as we go along. And we'll practice, and that's that practice that gives us the skill to go deeper. Okay, so having said all that, feel free to open your minds. I often, by the way, start just by, just maybe just like five breaths. Just let's start with the breath. Let's tune into where I am. And then I can either open wider or, oh, no, let's stay with the breath. That's how I personally started to work with practice. Other people do it in different ways. Find what works for you. So let's find that upright seated posture. And then I'm going to turn off my mic and we'll sit for about half an hour. And then I'll come back and we'll talk about lunch practice, everybody's favorite practice. Okay. So as I mentioned earlier, at this point, we're going to do what's called lunch practice. Notice the important word there, practice. if we're going to keep continuity of practice, then we want to keep continuity of practice in this space where you're going to have about 45 minutes to eat, to maybe go for a walk around the block to get some fresh air, maybe have a nap, maybe do some yoga to sort of loosen up the body, whatever suits you, right? And the trick is here is that as best you can, stay in the container, keeping silent. Please, please, please do not turn on your cell phones or your computers and check messages and that sort of stuff. Just resist. It's so much part of our culture, I know. And then as best you can, as you're going through whatever activities you're going through, note. See if you can actually keep the noting going the whole time you're just having a life, which is a 45, I'm giving you a whole 45 minutes of life here. Wow. But it's like, it's a life where we're actually putting what we've learned into practice. Eating, for instance, is an incredible opportunity to note the different sensations. Because when you eat food, you've got what it smells like, what it tastes like, what it feels like as you chew it and you swallow it, and what it looks like when you look at it, the emotional content of, oh, I really like this, and whatever it is, there's an enormous amount of sensation just in eating a meal. And so it's a great time to sort of slow down and really pay attention to those sensations. And then, like I said, go for a walk, but as you're walking, just sort of note, oh, I'm looking, I'm seeing, I'm smelling, I'm whatever's going on, just keep noting while you're going for the walk around the block. Or if you're going to take a nap, which is for some people what they need to do at this point, it's pretty hard to note while you're napping. But at least note as you're lying down there and you put your head on the pillow perhaps and you're going, and note the pleasantness of it all, and then you're going to drift off to sleep, and hopefully you'll hear the gong when I'll ring at to start again. So it's now, according to my clock, 12:28. We're going to take just a bit more than 45 minutes. So at 1:15, we'll start again. I will leave the Zoom open so we can all come back here, but I'm going to turn off my mic and do all those things. So as they say where I come from, bon appetit. So here we are, all full of lunch and smiling. I want to almost immediately have a sit to sort of get back into the flow of things. But before I do that, I want to talk about very briefly about two things. One is that at this point, right after lunch, is often the time when we get sleepy because we're full and all the energy is in our stomach, we're digesting. And so it's a really good idea if you find yourself nodding off to stand up and practice. Instead of having a sitting practice, have a standing practice. It's really hard to fall asleep standing up. So it's a really interesting thing. On longer retreats I've been on, this particular sitting period, the one right after lunch, would often have as many as a third of the people in the hall standing. So don't feel like, oh, there's something wrong with me because I'm standing and everybody else is sitting. Just stand up. And then you can always sit down again after 5 minutes if the standing wakes you up. So feel free to do that. The other thing I want to mention is that inevitably, no matter how good we are at trying to keep continuity of practice, we tend to get, with having lunch and going to the washroom and going for a walk and petting our cat and doing all those things we do at lunchtime, we get distracted a little bit. So I would strongly recommend that at the beginning of this sitting period, for the first few minutes at least, you do what we were doing first thing in the morning, which is just breath. just noting breath and staying with that and letting everything else be, just to sort of get back into the concentration groove, so to speak. And then once you're back in that groove, then we can open up to a wider form of practice. So other than that, I would just like to encourage you to settle into your seat, and we will get ready to practice for about half an hour. So yeah, about half an hour. So I'm going to mute my mic and away we go. So before we go for a walking practice, I want to mention two different ways you can approach walking practice, noting that we haven't really discussed yet. I remember the last time we talked about noting, we talked about the three-part step, you know, where we noted very precisely, you know, the lifting, the moving, and the placing of each foot. So this is the sort of the concentration on a particular object method, so to speak. But then we talked, you know, just before lunch about this sort of more open awareness idea of noting. And you can carry that very like lock, stock, and barrel wholesale over into walking practice, where you could just as you're walking, note what's most predominant in that moment, which might be, you know, any of the sensations, any of the sense doors being active. And then you just note what's arising at that sense door, doing a note every 3 or 4 seconds, just like we were before in when we were sitting. And having the sensations in your feet be the anchor, just like breath was the anchor when we were in the sitting form. So take that whole concept of opening wide to whatever's arising and just apply it in walking practice as opposed to sitting practice. Or, you can stick with the more, if you feel like the more concentrated form of walking practice is what you need to do, that's fine. Remember, just like I said, with sitting practice, we can go back and forth between those two. Those are like two poles, and we sort of shift back and forth based on what's going on. But there's even a third. This is what I sometimes think of this as the middle ground of noting. I practice this a lot, especially when I'm practicing outdoors. The thing about walking practice is your eyes are open, you're out there, there's just a lot more going on, a lot more sensation, particularly visual sensation, going on than when you're sitting. And we want to sometimes sort of acknowledge that sort of issue, I'll call it, for lack of a better term. And we can actually change noting to consciously choose to note the four main forms of sense input that we're getting when we're doing walking practice. We have the sensation of stepping, the sensation in a much wider sense of the body moving through space. So, you know, what's happening in our hips, we can feel our chest moving forward. We can feel the air moving past our skin as we move. I mean, there's lots of things going on there. Our clothes swishing against our body as we walk, those sorts of things that we just don't feel when we're sitting. And then we hear things and we see things. Those are the four main sources of sensory input as we're walking. So what we can do is sort of acknowledge that that's what's going on, and actually change our noting to a sort of quite a wide open way, but still in sort of a formal, precise manner. So there we are, we start walking our 20 paces, right? So for the first time, first 20 paces we're walking, and we know all we're doing is noting stepping, 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 stepping. Then as we turn to walk back to where we started, we then note moving, and we pay attention on a wider sense to what's happening in the whole body. Moving, 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 moving. Get to the end of that 20 paces. We stop, we turn around, and then we note hearing. Because, you know, we're at the birds are singing and the wind is rustling in the trees. There's the sound of our feet. I practiced some walking practice in a blizzard once, and the sound of my boots crunching on the snow was so incredible. So we're hearing, right? Hearing, 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 hearing. We get to the end of that 20 steps. We turn, and now we note seeing, because that's what, you know. So in the other three phases, we keep our eyes slightly downcast like we normally do when we're doing walking practice. But now we lift our eyes up and look. Not that we're looking, we're not trying to see something, but sort of be sort of turn on that eye sense more and actually see. Seeing, 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 seeing. End of the line, stop, turn, ah. Stepping, stepping. So you just go, you cycle through those four. I've also often thought, especially if you're practicing outside, another sense that's sort of woken up outside often is our sense of smell. So you could also have a fifth one, or if, I mean, some people are more smell oriented than hearing oriented. So you might replace hearing with smelling. So you can be a little bit flexible on what I'm saying here, but you see what I'm getting at is that here's a sort of much more wide open, and you're sort of walking at a regular pace. This isn't like slow walking, you know, taking 10 minutes to get your 20 paces done. This is just walking along at a sort of a normal pace and acknowledging that all these things are going on, but we're gonna sort of shift our attention from one area to another and then back to the start and do it again. I've had a great deal of pleasure practicing in this way, doing walking practices. In the woods at IMS, I spent a lot of time practicing exactly like this, and it was wonderful. Anyhow, that's my words on walking practice in a more open way. So either, and now you have really three choices. There's staying with the very focused, concentrated, just paying attention to this, the actual methodology of stepping, you know, lift, move, place. There's, you know, basically open awareness with an anchor of the sensation of feet on the ground, or this middle ground of, you know, the four modes, we'll call it. Any of these are appropriate. Feel free to experiment. In fact, it's good to experiment and see what works for you. So now we are going to take a walking period. And we're going to come back and continue on in about 22 minutes, let's say, at 2:20. So give you some time to actually do some walking and get some fresh air and wake up. So I'm going to turn off my mic and you can go and do your walking practice. So now I want to talk at some length, actually, about where I've been heading all this time up till now. And that's to talk about our reactions to what's going on in the world. What's going on in the world between the pandemic and the politics and the climate problems and you know, the problems with racial justice and everything. It's just our mind is just like full of this stuff all the time, and it can be very distracting. And out of that distraction, we get fear, we get worry, we get cravings for things to be different. We become exhausted. We're full of doubt how things are ever going to work out. I mean, all of these emotions are churning. Well, the Buddha talked very directly about exactly this. In a sense, being able to concentrate, which is what I, that's why I spent so much time looking at the physical body and looking at concentration, is once we have that level of concentration, then we're capable of looking at this emotional turmoil skillfully. And I actually want to read something from the sutta here. This is from the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness. He is very precise, in a sense, about what we need to do. And the very first of these dhammas, these areas of thought that we need to focus on, which is what the fourth foundation is about. It's about mental formations and categorized in various ways, is what are called the hindrances, the kalesas. And I want to read the sutta and then spend some time talking about this. But this is the actual meditation instruction that the Buddha gave. If sensual desire is present in him, he knows there is sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in him, he knows there is no sensual desire in me. And he knows how unarisen sensual desire can arise, how arisen sensual desire can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed sensual desire can be prevented. And then he goes through the other four kleshas: aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. And that's the entire instruction. Just pay attention to these is basically what he's saying. But he's talking about paying attention in a very sort of specific way. And I'll come back to that, but I want to make sure we have a clear idea of what the kleshas are. So there's these five kleshas. And remember that this is just basically a way of taking all the different forms of unwholesome, difficult emotional mind states that arise and categorizing them in one of these five categories, which is limited in the sense that often there's more than one of these things going on at once. They interact with each other. But it's useful to look at them in this sort of simple way. So the first of these was desire. But desire, we have to be careful with that word, because we all had a desire to come here and practice today. That's a wholesome desire. So this is a strong, uncontrolled desire. So other words are lust and grasping. Words that it's like, I not only do I want it, but I want it right now. And I don't care. I want it now. It's like this sort of very firm, forceful energy. And then the flip side of that is aversion, which has many forms. Anger, ill will, hatred, annoyance, irritation. So it can be from the slightest little bit to a huge amount. Fear is another one in there. And then sloth and torpor. Oh, great. I love those English words, actually. Sloth and torpor, which basically is like not so much laziness, but sluggishness. Lazy, you know, though laziness might be a good word, I think sluggishness is even better. It's that sort of feeling of blah, of being very unenergetic and very sort of inert. I want to differentiate this from tiredness, because sometimes we are genuinely tired. And when we're genuinely tired, it's not very easy to practice. So we have to understand that sometimes we're just tired, you know, and that's okay. That isn't laziness, or that's not sloth and torpor. That's just, boy, I'm worn out. Time for a nap, or time to go to bed, or whatever it is you want to do with that. Flip side of sloth and torpor is restlessness. Has other forms: worry, worry, when you think about it, when you're worried, what you're worrying about, your mind is like whirling, oh, there's this and this could happen, this could happen. And the mind is like really, so restless mind. Regret. Oh, I wish I had X, Y, Z. And I want to be careful here, and that's it's skillful to learn from our mistakes in the past. But that's a difference between that and regret, which is dwelling on them and using them to beat ourselves up yet again. That's regret, not skillful. And just a general term of agitation. You know, being agitated. We see a lot of agitation in the world today, fomented agitation in a lot of cases. And then the last of these kilesas is doubt, which has actually, doubt, interesting, has three distinct forms. There's doubt in the teachings. You know, oh, this Buddhist stuff, I don't know. I should have gone done some Tai Chi instead, or, you know, and we start to actually doubt the Buddha's word, the teachings of the Buddha, and we doubt them. Not skillful. It's good to question them. It's good to see, experience them for yourself, what he's saying. But that's different from doubt. Then there's doubt in the teacher, which I've experienced several times. It's where it's like you get caught in the space of, oh, yeah, the Buddha's teachings make a lot of sense. But this person just doesn't have what it takes. You know, I wouldn't let them, you know, organize a cat fight. You know, I mean, it's like the mind gets caught up in this ranting about the person and the personality of the teacher and how they're presenting it. And how you could do better, or that other person does it a lot better. How come we're stuck with this person, or blah, 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 blah. Mind goes there a lot, doubt. And then the final of the three, and probably the most insidious, and probably also the most common in our culture, is doubt in the self. Yes, these teachings make sense. Yes, this teacher is great, but I can't do this. I'm not good enough, smart enough, holy enough, sweet enough. Pick your adjective there, but we're caught in the sense of, I can't do this. And that's the most difficult because it's the hardest to see, because that the self-doubt always seems so logical. It seems so, yeah, I got that. So these are mental states that are always arising, just over and over and over again, they're arising. And what is it that we can actually do with them? How can we skillfully work with them? Well, first and foremost, what we have to do is be able to see that that's actually what's happening, that one of these kilesas has arisen. We have to be able to actually note, anger, lust, self-doubt, whatever it is. We have to actually be able to see that that's what's happening and note it. Because, and often we don't see this at all, because when we're caught in the kilesa, almost always, there's some drama, some mental drama going on, some story we're telling ourselves that makes it all so real and important. And these dramas, these stories we tell ourselves, always have a central character, me, at the center. Sometimes I'm the star. Sometimes I'm the fool, sometimes I'm the troublemaker, but it's always me, right? It's like mind movies starring me. Kilesas always have attached to them a mind movie. And we get so caught up in this story that we don't see underneath is this mental formation. that's actually causing us to be distracted. We invest in the stories because these stories are powerful, and because many of these stories are repeats. You know, we see reruns of the story many, many, many times. Sometimes we all have our favorite stories we tell ourselves, right? About XYZ that happened 20 years ago and blah, 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 blah. Then before you know it, there you're all caught up in the energy of that, the emotional energy of that story. And you're totally not paying attention to the present moment at all. You're either lost in the past, or sometimes the story is about the future. Now you're lost in the future, figuring out how you're going to avoid something or make something happen. But believe me, you're not in the present moment anymore. So the first thing, as I said, the first thing we have to do, the simplest way to deal with these distractions so they're not distractions, is to note them. Just be able to say, ah, that's what that is. Whatever, you know, so now we're noting at a mental level something that's arising at the mental level, at the mental sense door, which we haven't talked a lot about till now. And this is because if we don't see them for what they are, if we let these stories run, the stories, the kalesas, are in control. Our mind is just running on nonsense, on stories, on movies. We're just sitting there blankly watching movies, mind movies. But if we see them, then we shift them from a problem, a hindrance, to just something that we can note. Now they're just another arising that we note. They lose their big dealness. You know, now I'm just noting that this is what's arisen. The story recedes into the background, and our awareness, our mindfulness, comes to the foreground and just sees them for what they are and notes them. Bang. They lose their power. Once they're noted, they lose their power. Their power comes from us being blissfully unaware and letting these stories run on. And as soon as we go, now I know this story. I mean, there are some stories that are repetitive stories that it's even skillful to have a note, that for a name for that story, like, you know, mother fight story or whatever. You pick your favorite stories, but we all have them. Give them names. Give them, which gives them it's even stronger, like, oh, I've seen you before, I know who you are. Nah, 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 you can't catch me. But it's not quite like that. But that's what we're doing. We're actually, by noting them, seeing them for what they are, we take away their power to distract us. And it doesn't mean the story's not going to keep running. Because sometimes these stories are so powerful, they're going to keep running. But it's like now we see them as just a movie, and we're just noting, oh, there's that story. It's not a big deal anymore. It's just, here's what's arisen, this is what I'm noting. And then usually they just go away because they crave attention and you're not giving it attention anymore. They're gone. Often we very quickly replaced by a different story, but that's a separate issue. So that's what we have to deal with. We have to deal with the fact that we're in a time where things are so distracting that we are just continually being caught by one kalesa or another, or in some cases, multiples. I'm thinking fear and anger are very often tied together. Something makes us afraid, and then we get angry that something's made us afraid. You know, this is what one of my teachers called an MKA, a multiple kalesa attack. You know, it's like too much going on all at once. So how else can we deal with this? And The interesting thing about the kilesas, and of all strong emotional states, which is really what kilesas are. Remember, I'm using emotions, the word emotion here. I could be using the more formal word mental formation or unwholesome mental formation, perhaps. But that's what they are. They're just things that arise in the mind. The one very useful thing is all of these mental formations have very strong physical correlates. And often the first clue we'll get that we're caught in the kilesa is we'll notice the physicalness of it. Which is why, by the way, the Buddha spent so much time talking about mindfulness of body, why that came first, and why I spent so much time today talking about it, to be honest with you. Because once we have that sort of mindfulness of body flowing, then we can see these physical things that arise when the kilesa is present. And that'll be like, oh, look at that. So here's my five. Yours might be a little different, though. These are pretty universal from what I understand. So for strong desire, lust, grasping, there's a sense of literally physically leaning forward. It's like we go, I want it, and I want it now. We lean in to those energies because we want it. It's like we're literally halfway out of our seat, ready to grab it. So the sensation is a leaning forwardness physically. With aversion, there's always associated with aversive mind states, particularly anger, but other ones as well, of heat. You know, burning with anger. So you're sitting there and all of a sudden you're thinking, oh, it's getting pretty hot in here. Oh, and then you see that story is all about that blah, blah, blah guy that did that and blah, blah, blah. You know, I won't go into the details of the story, but you know what I'm talking about. You know, these old stories about someone who did us wrong, or the old stories about someone who's doing us wrong right now or who's going to do something wrong to us in the future. They're all the same in that sense. And we get hot. Literally, the heat in the body generates heat. Sloths and torpor is pretty easy because it's like sort of droopy. It's soft. It's mushy. It feels like the mind has got like a film over it. It's foggy. Those are all sensations of sloth and torpor. Whereas restlessness, worry, regret, agitation, is the opposite. It's like, you know, ever do practice and you can't sit still? It's like you sit there and like, oh no, my foot's not quite in the right place. I think I'll move it 2 centimeters to the left, and then it'll, you know, and then, well, no, I moved it too far. I'm going to move it back. Just, you know, and we can't sit still. This is restlessness and agitation arising in the physical body. It's like our mind is jumping like this and our body's jumping along with it, literally jumping along with it. That's what my mother used to call having ants in your pants. You know, it's like you just can't sit still. And then there's doubt. And all forms of doubt have the same common physical energy, which is tightness. It's like you sort of are closing in and tightening and squeezing. It just feels, ugh. But it's like, it's almost cool, but it's tight, it's closed, it's restricted. It isn't open anymore. The heart's closed by doubt. So these physical correlates are useful because often, because we've become skilled at paying attention to mindfulness of body, we'll see one of these stories will be running, but our mind is going back and forth. Sometimes we're paying attention to the story. Sometimes we're still being mindful of the body, and we'll see, oh, look, look at all that tension in the body right now. Oh. And then you realize this story is all about doubt, and then you can note the doubt and let the story recede to the background. Now it's just become something, an object that, that story, that doubt is just an object of meditation. It no longer has its power. You've replaced it with your mental capability to see doubt. Now, here's a big problem with what I've just said, and that's that it's very easy to fall into the place when we start really looking at the kalesas to self-blame. Oh, I'm so full of doubt all the time. Oh, I'm one of those angry people. You know, we just let this ability, because we now have the clarity of mind to see them, become a really skillful way to beat ourselves up. A really skillful way to just feel crappy about ourselves again. And this doesn't do any good at all. In fact, all it does is create more aversion and more doubt usually. It's like we have to be very aware not to self-blame. All of these mental formations I've just been talking about are all perfectly natural, normal human sensations. That's all they are. They're just mental formations that arise. And often they arise totally out of the blue. We like to think that somehow or other we should be in control of our minds, right? And I'm here to say, sorry, not a chance. You do not have any control of your mind at all in the terms of what arises, what story pops in. You know, some totally random event happens that reminds you of something and the story starts. And you had nothing to do with that a random event occurring or anything. It's just there it was, and there's that story running, just like that. We don't have any control over what arises in our mind, which when you think about it, is actually quite a relief, because now I can't be blamed for all that nonsense that's always there. Thank God I'm not responsible for all of that. All I can be responsible for is how I react to that stuff that's arising. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where this teaching on kalesas is so important, because it allows us to have at least some control, at least some sense of, okay, I can be skillful about what's arising. That's really what we're talking about. Here's a skillful way to work with all that stuff that's arising in the mind that it distracts us from being in the present moment. So one last thing I want to talk about is that when the Buddha actually talked about this, he said five things. He said, we should know that it's present. We know when it's not present. We know what can make it arise. We can know what can make it go away if it's arisen, and what we can do to make sure it doesn't arise again. So for each kalesa, we have to look at that from five different layers, which is a lot of stuff going on, basically. But I want to talk about this a little bit. I also want to read a little bit. This is from Anna Lyall's book, Satipatthana. The use of the term hindrance clearly indicates why these mental qualities have been singled out for special attention. They hinder the proper functioning of the mind. Under the influence of the hindrances, one is unable to understand one's own good or that of others, or to gain concentration or insight. Learning to withstand the impact of a hindrance with awareness is therefore an important skill for one's progress on the path. Pretty clear. So, but let's look at these five different aspects of a kalesa that the Buddha talked about us being able to note. One is, what I've spent most of the time talking about, when a kalesa has arisen, when it's present, we should be able to note that. But equally important The next one, when the kilesa is absent, we should note that as well. This is a bit trickier because how do you know that something's not there? But well, often this is you've been caught in some story, you know, you see it, you note it, the story goes away. There's a very distinct physical sensation there too. It's like, like we've been released from this unpleasant physical mental state. It's very clear often that that's what's happened. And you can just note no anger. Just note that. It's very important because now we're noting the positive as well as the negative. This prevents us from falling down the kilesa rabbit hole of just seeing all the bad things that are in our mind all the time. God, my mind is just full of this bad stuff that never stops, blah, 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 blah. We don't want to go there. So, and seeing when they're not there is as important as seeing when they're there. Because it encourages us. It's like, oh, look, I actually have wholesome mind states. Isn't that great? Then we have, know what can cause it to arise and know how to remove it. I'll talk a bit more about removing it later. But know how, both of these are what I'll call right understanding. This is like the first step on the Eightfold Path. We have to have an understanding of how we end up getting keyed to have one of these mind states arise. Because often we act or speak or do something in a certain way out of habit that brings these stories back over and over and over again. And so understanding what the mechanism is sometimes behind the arising of this story yet again is sometimes skillful, how it can arise and then how you can remove it. Well, we've already talked about that to the extent of, you know, noting it is the first step always in removing it. Just like I see you for what you are. And those are both right understanding. And then how to keep it from coming back. This is right intention, I think, as much as anything else. It's like we have to have the intention not to do those things that we know lead us into these mental states. We have to, you know, I know that if I spend too much time reading the New York Times about what's going on in the world, that my mind's going to end up in that grumpy place again. So it's important for me that I read the Times and sort of keep up with what's going on in the world, but I don't want to sort of like fall down the New York Times rabbit hole and spend 3 hours reading the New York Times because I'll come out the other side being really grumpy or whatever. You know, maybe your thing is in the New York Times, but that's my thing. But you see where I'm going. So we have to sort of look at our lives in a broader sense and form right intention to not go to places that bring us to the kilesa arising in the first place. And we have to, and we have to understand that that's our responsibility. That we don't have any control over what's arising in the mind. We do have control over how we use our mind, what we consume. And sometimes it could be food. By the way, that we consume too much sugar, too much caffeine, because if I have too much caffeine, boy, you'll see me dancing around. I become very agitated and restless, for instance. You know, I know that, so I really limit my caffeine intake to just in the morning. So that's what, for my body, works. And so on. So that's a simple example of what I'm talking about here. So that's what we have to deal with the kilesas. And so what I would like to suggest is that for now we're going to do a sitting practice again, is that we start to consciously give some attention to what's happening beyond physical sensation into what's arising in the mind. And I want to say this very strongly, don't go looking for kilesas. Don't go looking for trouble. It's going to find you anyway. Guaranteed. And just start to see how just seeing them for what they are, just, oh, this is just the mental arising. It's not even me. It's just something that's arisen in the mind. It's just a mental arising. There's no me there. Just see it for what it is and name it. Note it. Maybe note it repeatedly, 7 or 8 times in a row, because that's what you need to do with that particular. And just see how this shifts and takes away their power, and they just become all this stuff that's arisen in the mind, just becomes stories that you're noting. It's like you're watching a movie. And see how this shifts the energy towards happiness. And this is how we move from being distracted to being joyful. This is where I think the power of this practice is most evident sometimes, is when we start working at this level with things. We need to have that concentrated mind to do this, because we need to have the concentrated mind to be able to tune in to what's actually arising. But then once we have that concentrated mind, see what's arising, then we don't get overwhelmed, which is often what happens to us these days. We just get overwhelmed by the flood of stuff that's going on out there in the world, and it's like, and we fall apart. We don't want to go there. So let's not go there by consciously choosing not to, by seeing what's arising. So we'll sit. So find that comfortable upright position where you feel solid, where you feel erect, where you feel like the body can be comfortable at the same time. And then I'll turn off my mic and we can sit for 30 minutes. So yeah, 30 minutes should be fine. So we'll go do some walking practice, and everything I just talked about in terms of noting kilesas as they arise is a perfectly legitimate thing to do in walking practice as much as in sitting practice, or for that matter, in life in general. I mean, let's be honest, this stuff isn't useful in life in general. Why bother, right? But in terms of formal practice, in walking practice, if you're doing that open awareness where you're just noting what's arising, and when everything's neutral, going to the sensations in the feet, then just here, this is just another layer of things you can note, the actual kilesas as they arise, which is just as common in walking practice as in sitting practice or any other form of practice for that matter. So don't be surprised. I really value walking practice. I've had some of my greatest insights actually in practice during walking, not sitting. I think walking is a really important part of this form. So I encourage you to go. Also, at this point, we're all getting a little sort of droopy and tired. Doing some walking, especially if you can go outside and get some fresh air at the same time, will wake you up. It's very useful for the next, we have one more section of things I want to talk about before we're done. So other than that, I strongly encourage you to go and do some walking practice. And I'll see you in about 10 to 4. We'll come back. So there's one last thing I want to talk about. And that's this whole idea where the Buddha in his instructions about the kilesa said, know how to remove it. And at first glance, when I first encountered this instruction, I was confused, to be honest with you. Because when you look at how mindfulness is normally taught, at least certainly how I was taught, there's a huge amount of emphasis on, you know, just not trying to manipulate reality, just paying attention to what actually is arising. That, and you keep hearing that, oh, pay attention to what's, how many times have I said it today, for instance? I mean, you know, it's just, it's part of the standard instructions. And so the thought of like removing it is like, gee, how's that, how does that fit in with this whole idea of just being with what's actually arising? But actually this idea occurs in many other places in the Buddhist teachings. And I want to mention two of them in particular. One is in the traditional teaching on right effort, you know, the sixth step on the Eightfold Path. You know, the second step is if an unwholesome mind state has arisen, do what you can to get rid of it. So this isn't like an aberration in the Buddhist teachings at all. And really what this comes down to is for a lot of these unwholesome mind states that are repetitive, where we've told ourselves that story many, many, many times. It's like, you know, there's that story again, and we're going, oh God, it's that story again. And we've been very skillful. We've looked at it. We've stayed with it. You know, we've gone, I'm sure you probably encountered the term RAIN, you know, recognize things, accept them, investigate them, and then understand that there's no self involved many times. And so where does this fit in? And this is another place in the practice where skill arises. Have I really honestly looked at this thing closely? Have I accepted it? Have I investigated it? And if the answer to all of those is yes, and then yet again, here it is, it might be the time to actually say, maybe I should just remove it instead. Another place where this occurs is in, there's a famous sutta called the removal of distracting thoughts, and where the Buddha actually goes through five different ways to remove distracting thoughts. And I want to just, I'm not going to teach the whole sutta because that's a whole Dharma talk all by itself, but I do want to read just one section of it here, where he's talking about, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time he should give attention to five signs. What are the five? And then here's the first of them. Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign, there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. When he gives attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. Pretty clear instructions. Like, sometimes it's skillful to actually go, nah, I don't need to go there again. You know, I've been there and done that so many times. I know, I've looked at it, I'm not avoiding, which is what we have, these instructions may lead to if you're not careful. I'm not avoiding. I'm just going, don't need to go there yet again. And this is where the skill is involved. It's like, are you being really honest with yourself? And have you skillfully really taken in that the energy of that unwholesome thought, and we felt it in your body and all those things we're supposed to do when we practice. And if that's true, then it's time to just change the story, essentially. So how do we do that? Well, he's describing there, basically what he's saying is, let's replace the unwholesome mind state with the wholesome mind state. So what are the wholesome mind states here? Well, gee, what a surprise. The Buddha lists four in many, many different places. You know, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. You know, the Brahmaviharas, the four classic things that we're told to cultivate. These are wholesome mind states that were over and over and over again in the teachings told to cultivate. And in the Theravada tradition that I'm part of, it's certainly metta that gets the biggest amount of play. You know, in other traditions, in Mahayana traditions in particular, you'll see compassion be more up there. From the Theravada point of view, compassion is just loving kindness directed towards someone who's suffering. You have a heart full of loving kindness, you encounter suffering, and compassion naturally arises. So that's why in the Theravada world, so much attention is put on metta. So what am I saying here? Here's this story running in your mind, blah, 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 yet again. I've been there, I've done that, I've looked at it. Many, many of these stories, probably almost all of them, have someone else involved besides you, or sometimes it's just you. But it's like, there's like the bad person who did that, or the good person who's so much better than you, or blah, blah, blah. There's always some other person involved. And usually we're caught, the story is at least in part a rant about that person. We're having what we'll call unwholesome thoughts about a particular person in a particular situation, or maybe a set of situations, long history perhaps. And the rant is going on and on and on. This person did that and blah, 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 and they're so bad, blah, 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 blah. Just going on, right? Yet again, that story. And what the Buddha is saying here is, oh, you notice that unwholesome pattern, that kalesa of anger or desire or whatever it is has arisen. And just replace that with this wholesome thought of metta, of loving kindness. And you can literally practice metta right there in the middle of your Vipassana practice. Just pause, bring that person into the mind, see them very clearly, think about anything you can that's positive in their attributes, and then repeat the metta phrases. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. Like literally practice metta for them. And maybe you just repeat the phrases three times, maybe you repeat them for 5 minutes, who knows? But you consciously shift your mind from that state that you recognized as unwholesome to a wholesome mind state with the same person. This is extremely skillful practice. It's also not easy to do, obviously. But this is where we can actually start to remove, we can actually know how to remove it. This is one very skillful way that we can actually remove the power of those stories that keep coming back, is to change the story. Literally, we're changing the story. We're shifting to a different channel. I don't want to watch that movie anymore. I'm going to change the movie in my mind by just having, as best I can, thoughts of loving kindness. Now, I should also be honest, is that for some people, it's going to be very difficult to have thoughts of loving kindness. I mean, there are people in our past, and different people have different stories, where things, someone was perhaps extremely harmful. And so I'm not saying you have to like that person, Certainly, you don't have to love that person. Just have thoughts of loving kindness towards them, which is the thought that they'll be okay. Just that is all we're asking. We're not asking to change the world about them. Just shift. And sometimes even that's a lot. And then what we might do instead is see if we can just form the intention in the mind to one day have thoughts of loving kindness towards that person. That might be all we can do. And that would be a perfect practice. Because it's all you're doing is forming intent, a positive intention. Oh, that's the right intention. It's pretty much part of the Buddhist teachings. And then actually acting at the mental level as best you can to have that intention come to fruition someday. Perfectly good practice might be all you can do, and that would be fine. It's really interesting to do this with those stories, because it just allows you to not wallow in them anymore, which is where a lot of our own sadness and our own difficulties in life come from, these stories we tell ourselves. And we're just going to say, oh, I think I'll change the story. I'm going to shift the energy of this to something else. It's called cultivating wholesome mind states. Yeah. And this is where, people think of metta and vipassana as two separate worlds. And I think because externally their practices are so different, we think that. But when we sort of head towards the middle ground, they interweave and intermix in very skillful ways. And this is one of the places where it's so obvious that metta can be just as much part of your vipassana practice as anything else. And it might be that at certain points in your practice, practicing metta embedded inside your normal mindfulness practice might be exactly what you need to do. Having said that, I'm also in the midst of, another part of what teaching I'm doing, teaching a 7-week metta course. And sometimes just practicing metta in and of itself is also a very skillful thing to do, but that's all I'm going to say about that. But it's like metta just tucked into the midst of vipassana mindfulness practice in this way, just as a way to shift the energy, is a very useful thing to develop in your practice as a way to deal with things. Being very careful, as I've said, and I'm just going to repeat this one more time, not to just use this as a way to short circuit things. No spiritual bypassing, please. We've actually honestly absorbed, looked at, dealt with, seen, investigated, whatever words you want to use, that story, that energy, that emotional turmoil. And now it's just enough already. Now I'm ready to shift it as one way to deal with it. So that's sort of the end of what I want to say about this whole idea of practice for a difficult time. So, but what I'd like to do now, of course, is, since I've just given some more instructions, let's sit one more time. And then we'll have some time for a little bits of closing energy afterwards. So, as always, you want to find that comfortable upright position. Feel like your heart is literally lifted up. Close your eyes. And I'll mute my microphone and we can sit for about half an hour. One more time. see you all again. See you again in some other place along the Dharma Highway.
Yeah, definitely. Take care.
Okay.